Welcome back, everybody. This is Eric and Matt, and this is Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit, your beacon of freedom and the American way of life. Tune in every Friday for a new episode as we dive into the world of liberty and what makes our country great. All right, today we're going to dive into the subject of, I saw an article recently, and they had mentioned that, so this is kind of a dual-pronged thing. So one, you know, we're talking about a whole, I guess, like an entire battalion of Marines are going to be issued suppressors as a standard issue item.
Yes, I did see that.
So that's cool. We want to discuss that. And we also want to sort of pose the question. The military has been talking about replacing the M4 and potentially even replacing 5.56 as our, you know, standard issue cartridge. So we want to dive into definitely a few things to discuss here. So there's a few questions in play. The military has definitely taken some interesting paths, and they've done a lot of research and development. I'm sure the Army Marksmanship Unit has put a heck of a lot of time and effort into, you know, discovering what could be the next infantry cartridge. And Matt and I, because of our background, maybe we can provide a little bit of insight on our experiences and sort of discuss this. So, you know, the AR-15, M16, M4, whatever nomenclature you want to look at, it's been around a long time, and it's a proven platform. It's a proven system. It does have its flaws and its merits, but I guess let's just start there. I mean, should the military replace the M4?
You know, I have mixed feelings about this because I feel like you could be in two camps. One camp is the, well, yes, technology is always changing, and there's always advancements in different technology and mechanical prowess as far as making new firearms and the way that those actions work. And then the other camp is the two world wars camp, where you just don't want, you're seen as someone that doesn't want to leave the old technology, and you're kind of stuck in your old ways. Kind of how in Vietnam, there are the guys that would, I'm not using that because it doesn't have any wood and it's a plastic gun. So I think that you and I, Eric, are in a unique position where we can see both. Because of what you do day to day, you do get to see some really cool advancements in technology and firearms technology. But we've also both used the older technology in battle. So we've kind of seen both sides of it. You know, I think that the manual of arms for the M4 and the M16 AR-15 style rifle lends itself to being very battlefield friendly. It's extremely easy. Maybe it wasn't when it was first introduced, but the takedown on it is really simple. The cleaning of it, I mean, is very simple. The cartridge, the 5.56 cartridge, also some would say the 223, but there are some minute differences there, chamber pressures and whatnot. But the round itself is very, very effective for the weight to power ratio. So, I mean, if you start looking at, well, how much do you have to carry? That was the big thing with when you went from 308 to 5.56, you're carrying, you know, more ammunition. It's still lighter than carrying a full combat load of a full 308 battle rifle cartridge. And with all the advancements in powder and speed and burn and all that stuff, it's still a very devastating round. It's still very combat effective. And I think it's not so much that the advancements in bullet technology and powder, I think it's the advancements in body armor that's really kind of spurring this. We need a different cartridge because, yes, 8.55 will still cut you down, but I think there's just some advancements in body armor technology that's kind of pushing the military in that general direction of having to make some changes.
Yeah, and I think to sort of segue into the original question as well would be, okay, so should we replace the M4? I mean, I agree with you. I think the M4 is a battle-proven rifle. It has proven itself in terms of its ease of maintenance and its ability to run in a wide variety of different environments. It is a very, very effective rifle. And I like the M4 quite a bit.
As do I. I like it as well.
You know, the military has skated around a few ideas, like, you know, they introduced the M855A1 cartridge. Yep. So it's pretty gnarly. You do get an increase in chamber pressure. It runs at a higher pressure. It's kind of, you're getting a little bit more speed, and the design of the projectile lends itself to penetrating some much more substantial threats at longer distances. So they've already attempted to sort of say, all right, how can we take the M855 and wring everything that we can out of it? Now, I know that the magazine that you use has to have a specific follower in it in order to not chew up your feed ramps really bad. So they do have, I believe, some specific magazines for it that they've sort of worked around a bit. So there is that exposed tip, and it's a very hardened material, and it will chew up the feed ramps on M4 really, really, really bad. So, and because it's such a hot cartridge, it's a throat burner. So you go through barrels much quicker with the M855A1. So you can take a cartridge and kind of pony it out and get more power, but ultimately then you start to take a kind of a reverse direction in terms of the longevity of the gun. As you make that round hotter, as you go to, you know, much more effective powders with higher chamber pressures, as you increase that chamber pressure, you're going to burn the throats out quicker. The rifles are going to wear out quicker. They're going to require rebarreling and maintenance more often. They're going to wear out all of their appropriate components quicker. So I believe that the military's response to, all right, should we change the M4? I believe it, what led them to that is going, okay, M855A1 is nice, and it will probably always have some form of a use. And of course, M4s are always going to be in use probably for the next 50 years, right? So it's not like they're going away or anything like that. But I think the military kind of goes, okay, well, we wrung every bit of power we could get out of this gun, and here are the consequences, right? We're burning up throats. It's chewing up the feed ramps. There's just, you know, no way that we can get the desired effectiveness that we want in an infantry rifle without going to a different cartridge. We've seen that there's been a heck of a lot of talk, you know, in the AR community on the civilian side. See, normally a lot of these changes come from the civilian side of the spectrum, right? Now, whether it's the Army Marksmanship Unit going, hey, we should look at this cartridge because we're seeing some really good results with this thing in the competition circuit. Or, you know, I mean, the guys at the AMU, you know, they've got their own Corbin's waging machines. They can literally do their own jacket, bullet shapes, cores. You know, they can literally make their own ammunition all the way up from swaging their cores, you know, putting whatever custom boat tail or ogive they want on their projectile, making the projectile as long as they want. They can literally tailor their ammunition all the way down to custom projectiles that they swage themselves right there at AMU. Now, without getting down that rabbit hole, the point I'm making is that if the maximum amount of potential could be realized out of the 5.56, it has at this point. Both the AMU and, of course, maybe not the civilian side so much, but the AMU and all the folks within the proving grounds that do all this testing and everything for new cartridges and that develop cartridges, they know what they can get away with and what they can't. So right now, the M4 that we see on the battlefield today represents probably the furthest that we can take it, right? The military has switched in many cases to the 416, which is a piston-driven gun.
Right.
Now, I feel like it's worth mentioning that very quickly. The M4 that we have now is not the M4 they had back in NAM. Completely different animal, right? You know, we've learned through years and years of experience, hey, these propellants work better. This system, hey, we can do a piston system. We can do an adjustable gas system. We can add, you know, we can mess around with different gas system lengths. We can play around with buffer weights. We can change out triggers. So the gun that we have access to now is definitely not the old school rattly M16 that, you know, used ball powder and jammed left and right because it wasn't maintained properly. We've gotten past that. And I believe that it's just kind of worth mentioning that the M4 of today is definitely the culmination of what that gun can be now.
I agree with you. It's the culmination of what it can be now within the Geneva Convention, because there's a lot of things you can do that are outside the Geneva Convention that would enhance that round, but then you would get into a lot of trouble legally on the battlefield. I mean, you can do tons of stuff with, like, you know, you can up the core penetrators. You can do some really gnarly stuff with different metallurgy. But then again, you are now a criminal in the eyes of war, if that's even a thing.
Well, that 62-grain soft point FBI load that Federal loads, well, they call it the FBI load, but there's a nomenclature for it, but I'm not even going to try to spout it off because it's some long, crazy nomenclature. But there is a soft point FBI load that Federal loads, and it is a gnarly expanding 62-grain soft point, and I would most certainly imagine that it's probably not allowed in combat theater. But now on the civilian, well, I say the civilian side, but on the law enforcement side, the FBI uses it when they're going in, like, doing drug interdiction, or they're, you know, they're going to go in on some high risk raid or warrant or drug raid or whatever they're doing, right? And the situations are fine. These people are hopped up on drugs and running at them with machetes and pistols and stuff from here to the door. You know, they're so close. They wanted a round that could deliver a ton of energy, expand really well, and stop a threat close in.
Yeah.
And usually a threat who isn't wearing armor, right? So the FBI doesn't deal with people wearing armor. They're dealing with drugged up people that are, you know, obviously not in their right mind.
Yeah. So, and that's the thing is, you can, interestingly enough, use things in the U.S. that you wouldn't be able to use overseas in combat.
So let's segue into the cartridge now. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, the military wanting to lean towards a different cartridge for an infantry rifle. And it honestly, although I have heard talks of them wanting to develop a new platform, okay, and deciding what platform they want to use for that. But besides the platform, let's just talk about the cartridge a bit. So the military has fielded 300 Blackout. They fielded 6.8 Spec. And the 6.8 is a good round. It's definitely got some decent velocity, and it does increase your range a little bit over 5.56, I believe. Especially, you know, it's a good hard-hitting cartridge.
Mm-hmm.
I think what the military is looking at is more the 6mm bore, because you can get, you know, the ammo is still lightweight. You are increasing the bullet weight a considerable amount, but a 6mm AR or 6mm ARC, I guess, we look at the Sammy Spec version.
Yeah.
Hornady, I believe, released a 6mm ARC. And I believe that's one of the cartridges that they're looking at. And it's flat shooting. It increases your range considerably. Your average rifleman can easily make precise shots out to 600, 700 yards, even further, all the way out to 1,000 with a good, you know, 18 or 20 inch gun. Now, an M4 chambered in 6mm ARC, you could most certainly effectively, super, super effectively engage out to 5-600, no problem. We've demonstrated it quite a bit on our channel. We've shot it out to long range, and it is a great medium to long range cartridge. And of course, short range, you're really getting some good energy inside of a couple of hundred yards. So whether it's an in close fight, that cartridge has got, you know, some really good power. And of course, you could experiment with different powders and projectile designs. You know, an M855 style projectile in a 6mm, you know, maybe go a little screamer, get something lightweight, 70 grains, 80 grains in the 6mm arc with a penetrator, mm-hmm. good charge of powder. And now you're talking, you can penetrate armor, maybe longer ranges than M855. And you've got the ability to make point target shots precisely out to ranges that would be a little difficult with 5.56.
Yeah, I think chasing the body armor technology, at some point there's going to be the law of diminishing returns is going to take effect, because there's going to be a point in time where you're not going to be able to get a one hit pass through on body armor with the way technology is going. So, and that technology is advancing faster than firearms technology. So if you look at firearms technology, nothing has really advanced since the inception of the M4 or M16. The system, the way that the rounds leave the powder charges, yes, they're more advanced in a way that, you know, they're more efficient. But as far as getting much more power out of the same caliber, there's going to be a point in time where you're going to have to start carrying around a 50 BMG to penetrate this body armor to get a one hit pass through. So what is the alternative? I mean, you're going to have to start changing, you know, rifles every couple of years, which I think is probably not ideal for the military, because it takes 5 years just to get through the process of getting it passed through the government and getting contracted and all that. I think the 6.8 is a good medium, or even the 6mm. The issue that I see is the manual of arms, because yes, while there are AR platforms out there that emulate the look of the AR platform on the outside, the inside is where you start seeing the difference. So if you start looking at, say, like, you know, Nemo or Falcor or guys that are doing big bore AR rifles that look like ARs on the outside, but when you, everything on the inside is proprietary, and it's, there's no, that's the beauty of that original design, is that you can pull a bolt from one gun, and if your gun goes down, just throw it in there, or you can get parts from multiple places.
Well, I seriously doubt that they would ever completely phase out like the M4 and 5.56 as a cartridge. You know, just like anything that the military fields that's new, right? Mm-hmm. It's always going to go through its you know, situation where you got your tier one guys, you got Delta, and you got Special Forces and Rangers. They start fielding it before Big Army does, or Big, you know, Marines or whoever, right? All of your Special Forces type guys are going to field this thing, and they're going to report back, hey, man, this thing's great, or it sucks, whatever. And then they take that data and go, okay, well, maybe it's time that we widespread issue this or that. So I don't think that they would just throw, you know, Joe in a foxhole with it without testing it really well in combat. But I think as well, it can be a series of diminishing returns, because armor technology is getting so good when you look at the composites.
Yeah.
And everything, you know, there's composite armor that's level 4 rated that floats. Yeah. And now it's really expensive. Yeah, now, it's your brilliant. Average Joe may, you know, your average scrub may not get that. You know, we're going to get whatever Uncle Sam can buy for the bottom dollar. But it is worth mentioning that, you know, the armor definitely has advanced a lot in its design and what it can do. So I think those things are always going to have to sort of, you know, go along with each other as body armor advances, and also concealment. You know, it's worth mentioning that the Chinese are working on like active style camouflage.
I've seen that. Yeah.
And it's so good.
Crazy.
Yeah. It's freakishly good. So, yeah. You know, there are many ways that a soldier can enhance his effectiveness on the battlefield. I mean, having a great rifle, having a great cartridge, those are, of course, very important. But at the end of the day, survivability also comes down to being well concealed, the quality of camo, you know, how good of armor your soldiers have. I mean, all of those things certainly matter. And while we won't get into the minutia of that in this particular podcast, I just feel like it's worth mentioning that, you know, all right, if the military was going to switch to something like 6mm ARC, that would be one awesome machine gun round as well. You know, when you start talking, you know, like a squad automatic weapon or something chambered in 6mm ARC, you would certainly have, you know, a good bit of effectiveness there. Flatter trajectory, much easier to shoot and full cyclic rate, which would be great. So there are some benefits, and if they were to make a minor change to the platform to accommodate this cartridge, as I understand, they wouldn't really have to do a lot. It's just a different bolt and a barrel.
Right.
So it's still a short action cartridge. So you could still have rifles chambered in 5.56 that you could issue to whoever and be able to use up that ammo or however they wanted to run it. I think that would be difficult having a widespread use of two different cartridges. I mean, so the issue always becomes, right, you've got billions of rounds of 5.56 laying around. You've got hundreds of thousands of M4s laying around ready to go. So it's like, if you're going to change a cartridge, that's all good and fine, but you've got to change the rifles. And guess what? All of your armorers have to be trained. They've got to be equipped. They got to buy, you know, the units have to buy all the parts. And they got to be able to keep that up. You got to rewrite all the training manuals. You've got to, you know, change the way you train all your basic trainees and troops. You know, there's all a little bit of a difference, you know, in how you train, how you fight. You know, the training that a basic trainee recruit would get may not be the same training that we got, you know, 25 years ago or however long. Because as the weapons change, so does the training, so does the tactics.
Yeah, different doctrine, like, different all kinds of different stuff. So you might have, and that could even go as far as having complications on the battlefield as far as different brigades or different divisions, because there might be one brigade that has 5.56. There might be another brigade that has a different round, and they're trying to work cohesively on the battlefield. And they might have different tactics, different procedures, and different doctrine of how they do things. And I mean, that might be a stretch, but that's, you know, there's one small complication that could develop in the future. To go back to the special forces units fielding the cool ninja gear, that's always been a thing. That's kind of how they do the testing for a certain thing, because they'll get years of abuse in months. They'll get months of abuse in days. So that really gives those manufacturers a high level view of how much damage they can inflict with this new technology, but how much abuse it can take in a very short amount of time. But I think the Marine Corps is doing a great job of what they're doing with fielding that entire battalion of suppressed heavy weapons and weapons companies, because everybody is issued a suppressor, whether they're, you know, 240. I think they use a 240 Lima is the Marine Corps nomenclature. We use 240 Bravos. So they're 240s, they're 249s, they're M4s, M16s. Everybody gets a suppressor. So, yeah, could you imagine that, running into those guys? So they're going to get a huge sample size of data from this one battalion, and that's really going to help work out all the details to the grunt level. Because yes, while operators do get the ninja gear, they also have a full service of support staff that help them out. And yes, they take care of their own weapons, but they also have direct lines to support that can help fix these things when they go down or get replacements instantly. Line level units don't have that. When you're out in the field and something breaks, you're on your own. You have to repair it, or you have to figure out a way to make it work. So giving it to a bunch of grunts is going to be the end all. Like, we're going to have all the answers, essentially, because giving, you know, 10,000 people suppressors, you're going to find out real quick how sharp they are. They're either going to be able to fix this or they're not.
So there's certainly a lot of pros and cons to issuing suppressors wide range, like they're talking about doing. We'll go over a little bit of that. I'm sure we both got some thoughts on that. I'll just mention as well that it's interesting to see that suppressors have become so widely accepted now than they were 30 years ago, because it seems like there was a time where, you know, maybe even like, you know, Special Forces, Rangers, Delta, all of those guys might not have even fielded suppressors. And not necessarily because they didn't have access to them, but maybe they didn't realize the tactical value of them. Or maybe they were just intimidated by using them. I mean, there's always been a point where it's like, okay, what level do you take this to? And guys have been running cans on guns clandestine-wise, I mean, since before World War II.
Yeah, and they were using moderators in NOM. I mean, they weren't like full suppressors, that was the best technology they had on the battlefield at the time.
Yeah, I mean, well, they had, you know, pretty good can designs. Yep. I mean, so suppressors aren't exactly a new thing. I mean, they've been around a long time, long time. They had suppressed Maxims in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
So, now they were like giant oil can type things. But, I mean, they had some really interesting ideas, right? So, the idea of running a suppressor on the battlefield is not a new concept. But to see it this widely done, this could pave the way to every soldier, you know, and Marine, sailor, whoever, being issued a suppressor on the weapon. So, what would be some of the pros and cons? Well, some of the cons would certainly be upkeep and maintenance. I don't know what platform they would widely wind up, probably end up being used on a DI M4.
Yep.
It's not like everyone's issued 416s or have some type of adjustable gas system. So for one, you've got to set the standard issue M4s up to run suppressed reliably and without being overgassed, especially in select fire. Now, other than the logistical things of getting that sorted out, the soldier is going to have a slightly different regimen for upkeep. I mean, the guns run dirtier. They get a lot more carbon buildup, and they must be maintained much more stringently.
Dirty girls, man. Yes.
And you know that soldiers and Marines are going to start getting patches stuck in the end of the suppressor. And, you know, I'm worried about seeing them like walk off,
baffle strikes,
baffle strikes, yep. And you know they're going to lose their cans. Mm-hmm. It's just one more thing to keep up with.
Well, I think if they, I could, there's going to be a day where you're going through CIF and you're getting that issue. If you're in a line, I support companies, no, but infantry units, I could imagine going through and getting your CIF draw. And for you listening, CIF is your initial equipment draw when you get to your unit. You get issued your, like, all of your pro gear, like your pro mask, all of your ECW gear, everything, your nods. And those are things you have to keep up with for your entirety. So your deployment, you have to make sure you sign for it. You better not lose it. You lose a pair of nods, it's game on. They're shutting the base down. Everybody's online. You will walk that entire base for a pair of nods. Better believe it. So I could see them treating cans the same way. So you're signing for your nods. You're signing for your D-ball, your pack two, your pack four, your can. You're signing for this stuff, making sure that, you know, this is in your possession and you better turn it back in when you get out.
It would certainly be a sensitive item. Oh, yeah. For sure. So definitely on that list. So what would be some of the pros of having a suppressor? And I believe that they are much more subtle than people, you know, give it credit for. But the thing is like in the military, especially in infantry or any combat MOS, I mean, we shoot, we move, we communicate. So if you shoot and you blow your eardrums out, how can you communicate? How can you move? How can you communicate things to other soldiers around you if your eardrums are ringing and blown out? Or if there's gunfire erupting everywhere all around you, how can you relay messages to each other when it's just loud and chaotic? Suppressors allow the battlefield to have a little bit more noise control so you can have more effective communication. And in doing so, you are certainly going to be more combat effective, 100%. If you can communicate better, you can fight better, you can move more efficiently, and that will increase the combat effectiveness of those troops, 100%.
For sure, because what everybody sees on Instagram and on YouTube are these, high-speed operator units, and everybody's wearing Peltor or Liberator Ear Pro, and they all have boom mics, and they all have direct communication to each other. But on the line units, that doesn't exist. You get a high-cut helmet and 3M Ear Pro. So that's what you have, and you're running around, and the movies and, you know, YouTube make it look like everybody has this nice, calm communication, and you're running from room to room, and you're trying to develop the battlefield. Line units yell and use hand and arm signals. So if everybody has suppressors and you're able to communicate that much easier, it's that much more effective. Because there's points in times where you're just looking at somebody, you're waving your arm, you're giving descriptions, and that's it. And you're basically line of sight, you're yelling at them. So the quieter it is, even if it's like, if you're using supers and you're using a can, it's still going to help immensely.
Yeah, I mean, and cans definitely knock the edge off. I mean, you're running a full power supersonic ammo, you're still going to get a crack. Another, benefit of having a suppressor too is it helps conceal your position much better.
Oh yeah.
Now, while the gun will still crack, it will make the enemy have a little more difficulty in determining which direction the shot came from. So it does help in that regard in concealing the shooter's location a little bit. So there is that benefit, I believe, and also increasing the communication. And honestly, you know, it's been a long time since you and I deployed. So, you know, even a line unit now, you know, they may issue like the Commo and Peltor. I mean, it wouldn't be that difficult. If you're going to spend the extra money as a unit to field suppressors, which are definitely not an inexpensive item.
Not when the government buys them.
Well, we know that, but yep. But you know, if you're gonna go the route of having a can and issuing a suppressor, well, why not issue the Commo and the Peltors? I mean, that may be an approachable enough technology and, you know, reasonably inexpensive enough to procure as a unit that you couldn't have everybody on some basic comms. That would be a little bit easier to communicate. Now you combine that with suppressors, mm-hmm. and now you're totally, like, your ears aren't ringing. There's not as much chaos going on. You can calmly communicate, move much more effectively as a unit, and ultimately be much more combat effective.
I agree. The one issue with that is and I'll say this in a politely, we are not the smartest people in line units. And it's very difficult to get, let's just say, even if you have a platoon of grunts, you have to somehow get that commo on time. I wouldn't imagine you're just using like open comms, even if within the unit, because you still don't want people picking up on it, and they have the ability to do that. So you'd have to put them on time with free cop. I couldn't imagine trying to manage that between the units, plus getting it linked up to your vehicles, which was already a challenge. And I mean, I just think that using like your basic, I could see the squad leaders and the team leaders having it like they usually do. But unless they just make a simpler way to do it and get everybody talking at the same time, because it just takes if you're a couple of seconds out of time, no one can hear you. And it's just a chore to do it effectively.
Yeah, I mean, so it's really interesting to think about the direction the military could go. I mean, these types of things are not necessarily new. When the M1 Garand was originally developed back around 1936, 37, I mean, the mid to late 30s, might have actually been as late as 38 or 39, but when they were developing the M1 Garand, they developed a 10-shot M-block in a cartridge called 276 Peterson. And we're kind of in that same territory, right, where essentially, hey, you know, we've got a 10-shot repeater, a good flat shooting cartridge. I mean, the 276 Peterson is a great cartridge ballistically, and was. And the testing, they loved it. It definitely was not a problem in that regard. But Douglas MacArthur came up and said, wait a minute. We've got, 3 billion rounds of M2 ball ammunition. There's no way we're chunking all this ammo and then producing a whole ton of new ammo for this gun.
Right.
So they went back to the drawing board and they redesigned the M1 Garand to take M2 ball ammunition. And now you have an 8-shot because you can't fit 10 shots in the mag. They had to redesign the M block and now you've got an 8-shot. So that's why the M1 Garand is an 8-shot and not a 10, was because they had the 30-06 is a much larger cartridge than 276 Peterson. And they lost 2 rounds in capacity to upscale the gun to shoot M2 ball ammunition. So that rifle was developed specifically around M2 ball ammunition because that they had so much of it.
Right.
And of course, history shows us that having that, losing those 2 rounds wasn't a problem.
No, it was not.
Yeah, because the guys that we were going up against, the Wehrmacht and the Nazis and all, they were issued a 5-shot bolt action Mauser.
Yeah, that was.
And so, you're going up against a guy with an 8-shot Garand that can keep the air full of lead. That's definitely a force multiplier. So sometimes just sticking to, the original cartridge like they had at the time.
And it was black tip too. So it wasn't definitely no slouch.
Oh, yeah. And sometimes just sticking to the same cartridge and then just developing a great weapons platform to go around it was helpful. Now, they went from a 5-shot bolt action, Springfield 03 to a Garand. I mean, that's a huge step up in firepower. So the question we should pose here is, all right, if we've got billions of rounds of 5.56 laying around, and if there's something about the weapons platform that they're dissatisfied with to want to replace it, wonder if we should just try to, make 5.56 work and try to find a way to make M855A1 work. And then the question would be, what would be the platform that we would look at? I mean, what should replace the M4? I guess that's the next question we should pose. I mean, what would be a better rifle than an M4?
Well, I think that they are kind of going in that direction. I've seen some of them. I'm sure you've seen it as well. They have this new, in the Army, they're fielding this new kind of visor goggle system that it gives them like a HUD, and it allows them to, and a lot of purists, and I actually agree with this, they can basically not have to shoulder the rifle and look down the sights. That HUD is kind of giving them all the feedback and everything they need to shoot the rifle. So maybe it's not so much of, hey, let's change rifles and let's change rounds. How about we change the actual firing system? Let's make the troop, the actual person firing the rifle, more capable. So maybe they don't have to hit the body armor. Maybe that system will give them a better targeting system where they can hit him in the face or something. Yeah, shoot him in the groin. So it might just be you're looking to solve problems that, you know, don't really exist or something like that. But I have seen that, and I know there was like an original system called like the Future Combat System, like years and years ago, where they mounted a camera on the gun and you can kind of point it around corners. But the new system, and the name escapes me, but it looks really high speed. It's much less cumbersome. You're not carrying around like 40 pounds worth of computer gear with you. It's very like F-35 visor like. So I'm sure the cost is astronomical, but if the cost to create that is less than overhauling every single weapon system in the military's MTO, that might be the way to go.
Yeah, and I think that you know, no matter which way we approach it, 5.56 is always going to be what it's going to be, and there's only so many different directions you can take it to increase the power and effectiveness of it. And there's just limitations to any cartridge, right? There's only so much pressure you can load it to. Now, unless we have some crazy, crazy, wonderful advancement in propellants. Now, that is one area that has changed considerably over the last 40 years, is the development of newer propellants, which allow us to take cartridges into some really fast speeds without getting too much more pressure, because that's always the trade-off and the game that we have to play. It's like, as I increase that powder charge, I'm going to generally increase the chamber pressure as well. Right. So as you increase those chamber pressures, you get a much hotter burn on the throat. And of course, especially in a machine gun and full cyclic, you know, you get a lot more heat. And so then you're dealing with having to dissipate heat. Now you got to deal with replacing barrels more often. So there's always a series of diminishing returns where, yes, you can load it hotter. Yes, the military can experiment with, you know, better propellants. I think if they could somehow design a propellant that would give them, you know, a good bit more speed, but without burning the throats out on the barrels and increasing the chamber pressure too much, they could probably get a little more steam out of 5.56, but until there's better propellants, that's the only thing that I could – that would be ultimately the cheapest upgrade, would be to just design a really, really crazy good propellant. And, of course, I'm sure that they spend millions of dollars in R&D to chase that variable, because the propellant would obviously be the best way to get to the end goal without having to redesign the whole, you know, system.
And – As much as anyone wants to always push technology forward, there's always, and it's been proven, there's always going to be a much more or less expensive way to counteract whatever it is that you're doing. And a great example of that is the RPG-7. You know, everybody, when everything kicked off and they're trying to up armor all these vehicles to combat against RPG-7s, because they're devastating weapons when they hit. I mean, the way that they're designed with the shape charge, they're super, super effective. But to counter that, all you need to do is take about $25 worth of steel and build a grating system on the outside of the vehicle, and it just pinches the nose cone. So now you have this super effective shape charge that's rendered ineffective by a very, very inexpensive armor. It's not even a reactive armor system. It's basically just a cage that goes around it. So I could totally see something similar happening with any other round, whether it's a bullet. There might be another way to counteract that that's much less expensive. So you're throwing millions of dollars at something that is going to get counteracted by body armor anyways.
Well, I think it depends, because the thing is, and when we look at armor designs, no matter how good armor ever gets, the one thing that we know is a consistent is that speed is what penetrates armor. So the faster the round and you get it zipping, that velocity, it really plays hell against armor. So that's one thing that we see. It's like, you take a 408 Shytac or something and you
design.
Yeah,
buddy.
Oh, yeah. You get a 408 Shytac and you design one gnarly bullet. Like, imagine M855A1 Spirit of projectile
mm-hmm.
In a 408. And then you get that thing going on a case, crack and charge a powder. I don't think there's, I mean, that sucker would penetrate so much armor, it's not even funny. You could, dare I say, almost, you know, shoot through Bradley with that sucker. With the right bullet design.
You probably could get like the A1. Maybe not the new one, but like the original.
Right, but if we're talking a crew serve weapon in 408 shot tower.
Yeah, oh God.
And you're talking, you know, just, I hate to say, you know, but, you know, infantry in the open on the battlefield. Now, granted, they've got great armor. Say they've got the latest and greatest armor. Well, see, now you're talking, there's just nothing that's going to stand up that.
Well, even that, what is it, 300 Norma M134. I mean, that will chew you up, boy.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
And I know that I've heard of some experimenting that the military's been doing of, I don't know if it's 240 Bravo or some type of modified 240 Bravo, but I heard that, I guess it would have to be a modified 240 Bravo set up to shoot 300 Norma Magnum.
Yep.
And that is a great cartridge. It definitely gets into territory that 300 Winchester Magnum can't do, but gives you maybe even a slight edge, if not approaching very similar performance to 338 Lapua. So let's talk about that a little bit. You know, I didn't think about getting into this, but we'll break into this a little bit. Is the advent and the development and the predominance of the DMR, the designated marksman rifle. So the modern battlefield has really posed some really important and clear challenges that have to be acknowledged, right? You don't know if a gunfight is going to happen in a 50-yard enclosed building or if you're going to get shot at by a sniper outside that's a half a mile away. So soldiers on a modern battlefield, which typically in the last, you know, 20 years have involved primarily cities and urban environments.
Yeah, built up urban environments.
You never know. You may have to shoot 100 or 50 or, you know, take a shot at a guy that's trying to shoot at you with a Dragunov from 500-600 yards away down the road. So you've got to have a rifle that can do a little bit of both. And the advent of the DMR is pretty neat, you know. Especially you look at the challenges of places like Afghanistan, where in Afghanistan, the shots are freakishly long.
Yeah, mountain-to-mountain type engagements.
Yeah, I mean, the Mujahideen or whoever can lay on a hill with a 303 infield, and if 15 or 20 of them are lobbing shots at you fairly accurately, they're basically firing volley fire at you. They can be pretty effective with those things. And let's face it, I mean, a 303 infield can shoot at you from a long ways away, and your 5.56 is just going to be ineffective at that distance.
Yep. I think every single modern longest range kill was from Afghanistan. Like the last three or four, every time there was a record set, it was in Afghanistan. Just because those standoff distances were so long, you're shooting from mountaintop to mountaintop. In Iraq, we just didn't experience that. It was like in your face, like probably the longest engagement was like 100 yards, maybe, if that, but everything was pretty close in. But the DMR aspect of it, I think that's a very well-rounded rifle. I mean, I personally, I would much rather have a longer barrel. I'm not talking like 18 inches or anything like that, but something like a nice intermediate length, because I'd like to have something that can do both. And I think that's something that the Marine Corps definitely did right, is that when they originally issued rifles, everything was a standard length. You didn't see guys running around with, you know, 10.5-inch barrels or just real shorties. The Army did do that, but I think that was very mission specific. But I think that lends well to the mission that the Marine Corps was handling. It's very like, you just don't know. So might as well give them a rifle that can do both instead of giving them a shorty and not being able to accurately reach out and hit. And I know that you can hit longer distances with a short barreled, but I would rather have the confidence in knowing that I have that velocity and full powder burn while it's going.
Yeah, I mean, if you take something like a Remington 700 and it's chambered in, you know, I know a lot of guys run 300 Winchester Magnums with bottom metal. So you got, you know, bottom metal, detachable magazines,
mm-hmm.
300 Winchester Magnum and a bolt gun, definitely gives you some really good distance capabilities. I mean, with a good dope card and a good solid optic, that 300 Win Mag, you can definitely get out to some, you know, 1,400-1,500 yards, you know, get into some scary territory. But man, that 300 Norma Mag, now that thing is a throat burner. It is an absolute screamer. It's got a lot of power. It can really get out to some long ranges. And that's where you start getting into the mile club, you know, 2,000 yards plus. When you get into the 375, the 408, the 300 Norma Mag, I mean, and the 338 Lapua. So all of those cartridges in some way, shape, or form have been fielded by the military. And snipers, I mean, especially when you start talking, you know, Rangers, Special Forces, Delta, you know, people that can kind of have a little bit more of a selection of what they want to have in their MTO, they can field whatever the heck they want, really. So those cartridges have all been fielded effectively by all the coalition forces, not just United States, but all of us, of course. And I think the longest sniper kill was set by a Canadian.
Yes. Well, that was the last one that I know of. I think there was someone that broke that record, but the Canadian was the last one that I investigated.
Yeah, I want to say I think he used a Macmillan TAC-50.
TAC-50, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great rifle.
It is, but if you... Like to go to on the DMR front, typically DMRs are semi-autos or like accurized AR platform rifles. However, as much as I want to like, say like the big bore ARs, I know that like, again, I keep saying, I said Nemo and Falkor because those two like pop into my head when it comes to those like 300 Win Mag semis, but there's a reason that they use the in bolt format is because they're far more reliable. Everything that I've read about and seen, as much as I want to like that platform, it's just not very reliable in those austere environments. There's just too many proprietary parts, too many moving parts. I love them to death. Because, I mean, honestly, shooting a 300 Win Mag out of a bolt is a chore. I think we were talking about that like a couple days ago. Like, yes, it doesn't hurt, but it's not something you enjoy just because you're not going to go and be like, oh, I'm going to shoot my 300 Win Mag today. You know, it's not fun. It's more like, okay, yeah, I'll shoot you because I have to shoot you, but I'm not going to go and plink with it for fun.
And I think that also the shot recovery, you know, with a bolt gun, especially a hard recoiling bolt gun.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to really train yourself to stay on target well and work the bolt and be able to try to spot a bit. So there is that aspect. An autoloader does make it a little bit better in terms of being able to stay on target easier.
Right.
You know, load the bipod up really good in the prone, get in a good solid position or wherever you're going
to
be.
But there's more mass there to absorb that recoil as well. Yeah. They're more heavy. They can accept that mass a little bit better, that recoil impulse. And yeah. It is a little bit more acceptable.
The Stoner M110 as a system, you know, with its proprietary suppressor and everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, now that particular system is extremely effective.
I love that weapon system.
It is great. Yeah, the Stoner M110 is a great gun. And, you know, it is 7.62, which is fine. And honestly, what I've seen is when you look at, like, the Vietnam War and how troops, you know, didn't want to give up their M14s for the M16, right? You know, because there's just that stigma. And you saw, you know, how much more effective the 30 cal rounds were in the heavy brush or in the jungle than the little zippy 5.56s were. I think what you wind up seeing is when you think of the 7.62 by 51 as a sniping round, like it has been thought of for so long, and you look at the development of these newer cartridges, your 6.5s and your 6mm, and you look at, you know, things like the 300 Norma Magnum and even 338 Lapua, right? You look at these cartridges, and we have cartridges now that were purposely designed, or at least the spirit of them is more, lends itself better for long range shooting. 308 was just more of a machine gun cartridge that we said, well, just because it's got some, you know, good power, we'll put this in a bolt gun, and hey, it's accurate. We can get out to some decent ranges. It is an effective sniping cartridge. It's been used quite effectively, but the 7.62 by 51, just like the 50 BMG, while they were used for anti-material and sniping purposes, the 50 was
right.
That was just a machine gun cartridge.
Yeah, just like, link it.
Yeah, just like 7.62 by 51 was really more of a general purpose machine gun and and a rifle cartridge, I don't think they were necessarily thinking, oh, this would make a great sniper rifle.
Yep. I mean, they do have some like super match grade, you know, 50 BMG rounds, but you know, that's not something that, you know, the average person in the military, like the average line unit, because yes, you do get 50 BMGs, but they're not handing those out. They're like, some of them, I think, are like $27 to $30 a round to get those. I mean, they're highly accurized, but it was an anti-material rifle.
Well, I think that's why the Barrett M107 is such a great gun, because mm-hmm. when you take a 107 and you got 10 shots of 50 BMG in your hand, semi-automatic, you know, yeah, it's not a machine gun, but it's also not a bolt action.
Yeah.
So you're sort of, you know, you can hold some pretty extreme ground with a 107.
Oh, for sure.
You got
sure.
a few machine gunners in your nest near you. You got your rifleman, and someone starts harassing you from a hide 900 yards away or 1,200 yards away, or you see some cliffside where you can tell there's little bits of stuff popping off where they're shooting at you, and you start lobbing 50 cal rounds at them.
Yep.
They're going to stop whatever they're doing. So I don't think the reason the 107 was so effective and able to be issued so widely, you know, it's a very reasonably priced option. I think the reason it's held up so well is because it's not touted as a sniper rifle. It's an anti-material round that does really well. You know, oh, you've got vehicles coming, break out the 107 and put some precise shots in the engine block.
Right.
You've got a sniper in his hide. Blow them out of the hide with a 50 cal round.
Yeah, knock the sandbags over, man.
You don't have to
man,
hit them
you know?
On the first shot. Yeah. You just got to keep lobbing them. And that's the beauty of it. You can lay behind that thing and just take your time and shoot it slow and methodically. And it may not be pinpoint accurate at super long ranges, but it is accurate enough to fill that type of role. And I think that's why it's been successful. And it's super portable. You can pick it up and move it real easy. So the enemy never knows where the heck you are. Unlike a machine gun emplacement where they generally know that's where the heavy weapons are.
Yeah, I mean, you could, you lob enough rounds in there, you'll bring the roof down on top of the guy. So, I mean, you might not have to hit him. You just have to bring the building down on top of him. And you can do it with a 50 cal. I mean, you can do it.
Well, it's a good gun for saying, hey, I know you're there.
Yeah. So, I mean, given the advent of, you know, so the technology of the 107, the recoil system on it is really what kind of lends itself to being palatable. Because I'll tell you what, I would rather shoot a 107 than a 301 mag. And that's just because of the recoil system on the rifle. Like the way that it accepts that impulse and the whole barrel assembly kind of rocks back on you. It's actually not that bad. I think people look at it and they look at the size of the round and the size of the actual gun, and then they get kind of taken aback by it. But there's far more technology in that than like M24 that shoots 301 mag.
They're really not that hard to shoot.
Yeah.
You know,
they're very palatable.
I've seen 10 and 12 year olds shoot a 107 and totally not have a problem with it. I mean, if they're like a 29 pound gun. So it helps absorb a lot of the recoil.
Exactly.
And I'll mention this about 300 Win Mag. It can be a brisk cartridge. You know, it's got a good bit of recoil. But I want to mention quickly, too, that when folks experience shooting a 300 Win Mag for the first time, 9 times out of 10 in the civilian end of things, it's usually, okay, some guy bought a Remington 700 or a little Sporter or Ruger M77 or something, chambered in 300 Win Mag. Generally, those rifles are designed to be carried around a lot and shot very little. Because there's a series of diminishing returns. All right, while the rifle's light, it also kicks a lot more.
Like a mule.
If you take something like a Savage 10A, M10A, the 110A, or whatever. Yeah, those Savage rifles with the chassis system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now you can get those with the chassis, bottom metal, free-floated barrel. I think the barrels are fluted.
Yes.
Really effective muzzle brake on there. Now, you get behind one of those in 300 Win Mag because the weight, yeah, it's a little bit heavier. But the recoil, it purrs like a kitten. They are so easy to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
It is not like shooting a skeletonized, lightweight 300 Win Mag rifle. So I think for those listening, just understand that, there are some hard recoil and rifle cartridges you can get into. But don't be scared of them. Just understand that when you get into the real skinny barrel, lightweight hunting rifles, they are going to generate much more recoil than a heavy chassis gun would.
Yeah, and most of that stems from what they read in like in books. I know a lot of the special operator snipers, they preferred 300 Win Mag. But then you see a lot of the younger generation coming up on that, and they don't realize that they're using a chassis system with a really nice butt pad. Like they have everything at their disposal to mitigate that recoil versus 27-year-old Johnny going to Dick's to buy, a fiberglass stock that's chambered in 300 Win Mag, and he gets behind that thing and knocks his teeth out.
Yeah, with a pencil barrel.
Yeah. So, yeah, don't get me wrong. It's a great cartridge. It just comes down to what you have to shoot it out of. But, I mean, overall, I think that to answer the main question of the podcast, I don't feel at this time that completely overhauling the military's arsenal of, M4s and 249s. I think the 249s, they should just throw that away anyways. But the 240s, the M4s, all that, it still has plenty of longevity left in it. I don't think there should be a huge rush to spend, billions of taxpayer dollars on something that doesn't really need to be done.
I agree. And I think that when we start looking at increasing the long range capabilities of the average soldier, I think the way to accomplish that, and I'll quickly mention this because I know we're kind of getting close to time here, but my idea of like the perfect, infantry platoon.
Oh, lay it on us.
Yeah, yeah. So, let's just get down to the basics, like take a couple of squads, right? Like, fire team or whatever. If you were to maybe, and I think about it, and I guess it's always like mission specific, right? What you're getting into, what you're going to do. It always seemed like you'd want like maybe a guy with a shotgun, one guy with a dedicated grenade launcher.
Yep.
Maybe not an M79, but some type of dedicated grenade launcher, for your 203 or whatever, some type of grenadier. So
like a repeating grenade launcher. Yes,
something that you could really lay down.
Like a hellhound or something.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like you'd want a guy, maybe your radio operator run a shotgun. Just, if they sneak up on you and you're hemmed up, you got a shotgunner that can take out people up close or whatever. I don't know. Yep. I always picture like one guy having a shotgun. You need a grenadier. And then depending on the mission, of course, but generally what the military could do is just, as long as each platoon has got, four or five good riflemen that have a DMR that can extend that range out a little bit. That's why things like the Dragunov and the PSL were developed, for the Comblock countries to extend the range of the average rifleman. They didn't want to issue that rifle to every single guy. No, if you're on a line and you got, five or six riflemen, you might have one DMR for every six riflemen.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
Well, that's just what the DMR was invented for.
Yeah, have a few specially trained guys that can make those longer shots. And while your riflemen pin them down, then you get your DMR in there to make the precise shots to finish the job. So I think the military just needs to focus on training and developing, the DMR program a little bit more widely. And I think they could stick with the M4. They could stick with 5.56, and I don't really think there's much need to replace it. I think that they're doing a much better service by issuing suppressors.
Yeah.
And now once that becomes part of the doctrine and part of the tactic, well, then guess what? The more effectively you can move and shoot, communicate, what you're using becomes a little bit less important because you're using superior tactics to accomplish a job over trying to rely on more standoff distance or whatever they're looking for in a more powerful cartridge.
Agreed. And with the whole body armor, thing, yes, that you shoot body armor, I know it's multi-hit rated, but you hit that thing about four or five times, it's going to get through if you start loading some hot 5.56. So everybody, out there like, oh, my body armor is multi-hit rated. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to stop anything more than, four or five rounds. And most body armor isn't even multi-hit rated. So a lot of people put emphasis on, I want a one round pass through. Like, it doesn't even exist hardly to this day. So marksmanship, going in there, making sure that you're hitting the target. And if they're not down, you hit them till they go down anyways. So you're not just going to stop. You're going to hit them, pop, 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 pop. They're going down. Keep shooting. That's problem solved right there.
And I think also, too, you can't assume that just because someone is wearing armor that they're all of a sudden invincible, right? I mean, chances are, if a soldier is wearing armor, it is totally, totally plausible that you take a shot to the arm or the groin or the neck. I mean, there's many other places, and that's still going to take you out of the fight, right? Now, it may not present a lethal threat immediately, but if you don't receive medical attention, you will. So then that becomes down to the doctrine of, well, we want to wound him and not kill him, so then it takes four of his buddies to carry him off, and then that's taking five people off the battlefield. So no matter what way you look at it, I think that focusing on tactics, and I think the wide issue of suppressors is definitely a good move.
Yep.
We're going to see how it pans out. We'll see how it goes.
Should be interesting.
I'm curious to see how many accidents there are, how many of them lose their suppressors. I'm curious to see just how it goes.
Base lockdown will ensue.
Guys, thanks so much for tuning in to today's podcast. We've got many more great ones on the way, and this has been an interesting topic. Definitely make sure you drop us a good rating and leave us a nice comment. We really appreciate that. And guys, y'all have a wonderful week, and we'll see you next week.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Life, Liberty, and Pursuit. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else podcasts are found. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate that. You can support us over on Ballistic Inc. by picking yourself up some merch. And remember, guys, dangerous freedom. Have a good one.